The Conference Committee on House File 5 is back in session. Thank you for your patience this morning. We're just gathering some little tidbits of additional information in response to some of the discussions yesterday. We have, and thank you, by the way, to our staff. We think we work hard, but when we go home after a long day, they keep working for several hours more, and we don't take that for granted. We had some discussions last night, and staff folks came up with a couple alternatives for various pieces of that discussion. One was on the advisory group, and I'm missing Senator Hayden, but I know we had and I'm also missing Representative Liebling. She was just there when I looked to my right about 5 minutes ago. But we had a discussion about advisory group members reimbursing for their out-of-pocket expenses and that sort of thing. So they've come up with some language on that, as well as on the Representative Liebling raised a question about gun ownership. I think what I'm going to do is hold on that for a little bit because we've got Senator Hayden and Representative Liebling that I think would be want to be part of those discussions. The other thing, and we don't have an answer for this, but Senator Lori and I last night and the previous evening have had some discussion about the concern about having a provider on the board who's one of those seven members. And whether or not that provider, if we're going to have somebody that really does know what's going on in the world, whether they should
big piece of academia in the state of Minnesota. And so it is a big issue that I do think deserves some active discussion among conferees. If we were to remove that conflict as pertains to providers, I do think that the House has some good recusal language that we would need to make sure that we incorporated into the conflict section. But the Senate also has an extension of the conflict to close family members, spouses, parents, children, that needs to be part of the discussion as well. So with that intro, I guess we would
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I should pass out my two amendments I'm bringing for ideas. What's the mechanism to do that?
You just hand them there to Representative Schoen.
Okay. different ones. And I'll just describe my insertion into the process. I have two ideas that I'm bringing in. I think what we're talking about here is a really good start. But I also want to remind members that the governor is going to appoint these folks. And if you look at how he's appointed on the Stadium Commission and all the other appointments I've seen, they've been reasonable. They've been broad-based. There's no – if we were going to ratify them, I don't know if the Senate actually does ratify some people. I don't think you'd turn any of them away because they were too left or too right. They were just kind of sensible folks. Oh, did you? Oh. Okay. But on but I think on this matter, he's going to pick sensible people, and the fact they have to be ratified by the House and Senate gives even more credibility. And with all due respect to AIG, I don't think we're going to be picking the president of that group to come and be running our exchange. And I think this provider idea has merit. The two ideas I'm bringing forward, one simply restates the ACA language, the A390. 390? Representative Atkins, A390? Wow. That's got to be.
We were worried about that too, Representative Mabler. We thought they were mostly yours. I don't know.
Only 100 of them. But this language quotes from the ACA about the conflict, and it gives the governor and the people liberty to choose. And the other sentence came from, I'm not sure, Senator Lurie, if you were the author in the Senate, but a very good House member had a bill last year on this topic. And this language, down to the only 388 amendment, is a direct excision from that in last year's bill where it limits some of the members. And remember, this was a board of 19, so maybe the three is high, but you know, perhaps two. But I think at the end of the day, this discussion has merit. And I think if you're allowed to have two people who have personal knowledge of this area who actually know what they're doing, along with the House. See, my amendment came along with the House language that gives much stronger recusal demand. And so I think this gets you where you want to go. And I think it would help make the bill better. And I'm not just saying that like people on the floor who are trying to screw up the bill. This is actually trying to help you. I'm sorry, I question some motives, Mr. Chair, but I'm trying to make it work. All the amendments I'm bringing forward are meant to be positive. So thank you.
And thank you, Representative Abler. That fine member he was referencing from last year out of bill was me. I think you're right. It was 19 members on the board. We had three that would be allowed to have so-called conflicts and would have to recuse themselves if there was any sort of economic interest. And proportionately speaking, I guess that's kind of what the intro that I gave on the – we might have out of the seven. We talked possibly about one if it was a provider that might have a conflict in which they'd have to recuse him or herself. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would really oppose this. I really do believe that 1 year, just 1 year out of the field is next to nothing, and I think that really does protect us better against a conflict of interest. And I know I just think that this is asking for trouble, quite frankly, and I really do believe that with the advisory committees that we have, there's going to be plenty of people on those that are still in the field, and as little as the board is required to meet under this current bill every quarter or whatever, and I know they'll meet a lot more than that in the beginning, I think the advisory committees will have a pretty significant role. And if we've got people from the healthcare industry and the insurance industry on those advisory committees, I still believe that they have plenty, will have plenty of say. So I would reject putting any members on the board that are currently in the field.
Okay. And thank you, Senator Goodwin. Just so we're clear, by the way, on that, is I think it all we talked in theory about is if you had happened to have a provider that was appointed, then they would be subject to the recusal, the House conflict of interest language, so that they'd have to disqualify. It wouldn't disqualify them just because they were still in the practice of medicine or still an active nurse, but they would be subject to the conflict of interest statement. That's just for purposes of clarity. Was there other comments? Senator Lurie?
You know, I guess I would just say, and I do believe that you're Representative Abler trying to help in offering these amendments, but that we did have this discussion at, I don't know if it was all or most, but we had it many, many times through the committee process. We spent probably as much time on this on the Senate floor as you guys spent on your whole bill on the House floor. And the Senate position is pretty strong that we not allow direct financial conflict of interest on this board. I just really think you're going to have a hard time getting the votes from our side to get either of these amendments passed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
That's right, I forgot who was in charge today. Mr. Chair works for both of them, though. That's kind of handy. I appreciate that, and I respect it, frankly. I'm disappointed. I'm trying to get this bill so I can vote for it. I'm trying to get this so that there's that it actually works, and that some people in the audience who have long sought a Minnesota exchange from the business side want to be part of the crafting the bill and be part of celebrating its signing into law. And so I know it pushes the Senate a bit, but I ask you not to dismiss it out of hand. If you're not going to do this, Senator Lurie, if you're not going to do this, at least you got to have a provider on there. As a 34-year provider who's been at sometimes victimized by the system and made very hard to work, we do not want to create a system that's built on theory where you have people who live in an academic world and who don't have day-to-day connections with what goes on in the business of this. So if you don't take my deal, and I have only one vote, I think Representative Atkins has floated something that just makes a tremendous amount of sense, which at least is productive. And providers, even with the people that are concerned about conflict, nobody's worried about providers. They're worried about the insurance influences. And I think if you adopt every sentence you could adopt that's in the side-by-sides, the House language about recusing and no family, and with this exception, at least that makes it better. So thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Well, I'm not sure about these two amendments, but I would have no problem having a practicing medical person on the board with the he or she has a conflict, then they have to recuse themselves. But you know, I've been on so many task forces on this. Just the task force for the exchange, and you go before that to the Minnesota Medical Association that really started healthcare reform. They had an independent board, and I have had interactions with huge numbers of practicing medical people on these kinds of boards, and I have never, ever seen them take their own personal financial interest, and they just have the knowledge that this board is going to need. And if you have a board that's entirely retired or has no real expertise in the area, then I think it's doomed to not be very good. And there are all kinds, and the governor is going to select the person. There are all kinds of people that I know would be very good on this board from around the state that, while they are practicing, I would agree that I think it's important to have somebody that's practicing and not retired.
Any other? Senator Sharon.
May I just to inquire as to, in order to at least challenge my own thinking about this, which is in disagreement with the perspective, I'd like to hear Senator Representative Huntley or anyone. What is it that you think that a health professional in the practice of health care, in terms of their knowledge, is important in terms of its seat on the board that represents consumers and make sure that the system works for consumers. That's so important to be there as opposed to an advisory process where the board asks for input from a provider from their perspective because of the worldview that that person is coming from on the board. What is it that you're talking about as it relates to an insurance exchange that a person practicing would bring that is so important? What is that?
Representative Hunley.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, it just seems to me that we're not just talking about an insurance product like automobile insurance. We're talking about people's health care. The primary purpose of health insurance is to get people the kind of health care that they need. It's not so much the insurance part of it. It's the health care part of it. And I just think that the mindset of the organization, the board, ought to be aimed at health care, not just the insurance end of it. As we go, if you look at the Affordable Care Law, it's just full of things to change the way health care is delivered. And one of the things that the exchange is going to have to do is look at health plans and decide things other than whether they're financially able to do what they say they're doing. My question is, are those health plans that are going to be approved, are they going to have a health plan that has providers that will do the kind of health care that we need? And I just think that a practicing medical person just has the knowledge of that kind of part of the thing that people that haven't been in the real practice will not understand. Again, we're not talking about automobile insurance or fire insurance. We're talking about health care. And I think that this board needs to have that view of what they're doing.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. One of the things that does trouble me in the way that our conflict of interest is drafted right now is the exclusion of some of our best research institutions in that it would exclude folks from the U of M. So, I mean, I think I am leaning toward allowing this with the recusal. And I think it might have been overstated when it was said that nobody has any concerns about a provider on here. I mean, and I'll just say what I have heard about the concerns and where this came from is that where the conflict could arise is in discussions around network adequacy and networks. It is to a provider's benefit directly to be included in networks, and that's where that conflict could arise. But I think I personally am comfortable not considering that a conflict that would rise to the level of precluding them from serving on the board as long as we had the strong recusal language that the House had worked on. We hadn't we'd kept it the direct prohibition through the Senate conversations, but as I started working through what the House had been through and thinking about academia and how we're sweeping more broadly than I really had intended, it's not without concern that we approach this there, but with the recusal, I think that the expertise and the value that a provider could bring, we should maybe not close the possibility that within still the members that the governor has to appoint, one of those might actually have that affiliation or be a provider. And I do see that as different than expanding the board. You know, I think that the composition of the board is good, but if we were to remove the conflict, I think I'd be okay. I mean, so if, you know, I guess just to put it in concrete terms, if we took the House language on conflict of interest, again, on page R7 of the revisers, side by side, on line 534 and line 535, if we struck institutional health care provider or other entity providing health care, but kept the recusal language in the paragraph B there on 6.3 to 6.7, I'd be probably, I'm not making that motion right now, but that's something that I probably could support. I see some concern. I would also want to include the Senate's extension of the conflicts to close family members, though. That's something that I...
I've got Senator Sharon and Senator Goodwin. Senator Sharon.
I would like to ask Senator Lori. I would like to ask you, Senator Lori, as you're looking at your concerns about the University of Minnesota and about the access to perhaps the research or academia to be members of this board, would you articulate that more clearly as to why you see the university in your mind? The availability of experts that are there, that we could not seek that without seeking a practicing physician or a practicing nurse or a practicing healthcare provider of some sort.
Senator
if someone
Lord.
Is clearly not in the practice but is in academia, teaching in the law school, teaching in the classroom, as opposed to clinical supervision or clinical.
Senator Lori?
Well, you know, I think that Senator Sharon, Mr. Chairman, that was one of the things, the making sure that we didn't exclude academia is one of the things that brings me some comfort level. You know, the experience that a provider has that was well articulated by Representative Huntley and Representative Abler as well, too. You know, when we got behind this, I think that we probably, I think that we may have cast the net a little too wide for both of those reasons. But one of the reasons, you know, one of the things that I'm really looking at is making sure that we don't exclude too much of academia because of their role as a healthcare provider as well. So
It seems to me you could have language that narrowed that. If I'm not sure I agree with that, but you could narrow the language in terms of its expansion to be someone who is a licensed healthcare provider that is exclusively engaged in research or academia and not in the practice of under which you are reimbursed. And I would like also to talk about why I think that the expansion of this overall is not a good idea. I'd like to challenge the thinking about why this expertise from the healthcare provider isn't better resolved through an advisory process than actually on the board where the vote has taken place. I'd like to talk about that further. But in terms of your concern, separating that. Is there a way to get at academia, if that is your issue, without moving this whole other world opportunity to the board?
Senator Lori.
Senator Sharon, there's another piece. You know, one of the things that we say frequently is about retirees being able to gain access to the board. And when you think about that in terms of providers, it does become a little bit different picture because most of our providers, even when they, you know, get on in age and quit their active practice, they stay licensed and still continue to see a small handful of patients. And I've experienced this myself. And so, I mean, I think that that's another distinction between a field where the concept of retirement that could remove the conflict and allow you to serve on the board isn't really quite applicable in the same way as it is in other parts of the industry.
I'm sorry if I confused you. I was not opposed to the idea that a licensed person in healthcare could be on the board, could be an academic, according to what you, but not engaged in active practice. It's sort of like in the insurance industry. We're open to the idea that a person who is no longer active, is retired, could still be tapped to be on this board, but not be engaged in the process where their economic interests is still active, is still active. Mm-hmm. That's the issue in the conflict of interest. And since there is a capacity to get that expertise to the board through the advisory process, I think we have to be very, very, very – we should caution on the side of protecting the decision-making process for the consumer, for the best interest of the people, because that information can come. But if you're on the board, it's going through a filter. It's going through a filter of interest. And even though even the view of the world, for example, I'm a provider too. If I was on that board, it would be going through my particular way of thinking about how to organize, control, manage, supervise, direct healthcare, including other members of the healthcare system, including other members of the healthcare system. And so you give way too much to a decision maker on the board, to a particular person coming from a particular interest and perspective about healthcare and how to approach healthcare. And I think that that is not in the best interest of the rest of the people who want to make sure that this board remains, as best we can keep it, away from conflict of interest.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Goodwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess Senator Sharon said everything I was going to say. I really believe that the board will have plenty of expertise. And people that are just removed from the occupation for a short time should not have any trouble being experts on the board, nor should the board have any hesitation in calling other experts or other people from academia before them, and being able to have them present to the board. They can have anybody they want present to the board. It doesn't have to be an advisory committee. Even if the board decides they want an expert from the University of Minnesota, they could get an expert to come in and talk to them about an issue or about some particular part of the healthcare exchange. But I really don't think we need to name one to the board.
And let me just give you an example.
Senator Sharon and then Representative Abel.
Well, that's fine.
You're on a roll, Senator.
I just will say one more thing maybe about this. I'm going to compete with you for the microphone a little bit today. The conflict of interest, from my perspective, for a healthcare professional, it goes beyond the economic interests. It goes to the organizational thought process about the provision of healthcare. Is it hierarchical? Is it a medical model so that the reimbursement of practitioners is controlled by the insurance company and decisions are made about who is and who isn't? Those are issues of that can create conflict. We have so many of those conflicts in front of us in the legislature all the time. Scope of practice issues, licensing issues, all of those issues about who should or shouldn't be covered. And if you have that worldview that has a conflict because of their interests, of their particular worldview about how it should be done, it creates a lack of confidence in the rest of the profession as to whether or not that board is going to be making decisions on the correct basis. So I really am encouraging us to do the best we can to keep this as conflict-free as possible. Because we have an alternative in which we can get these perspectives, just as we do in the legislature, where we have the capacity for experts. And I can't imagine a board that would not ask for and seek important information about provider networks. What are we doing that if we disallow certain insurance policies, are we excluding all sorts of providers from being able to practice? I can't imagine a board not wanting to examine that question without being in the practice themselves. So my appeal is to the House to really be very careful about this and to think through what door you're opening when we don't keep it clean, keep it really clean.
And Representative Abler?
Well, thanks, Ms. Chair. And I thought I said what I was going to say, but I'm going to say a couple more things. I just picked up on I want you to understand what you were doing here. This is 68 times two. What's that? $136 million a biennial project. It's going to insure 1.3 million people. I remember when I was a freshman, I succumbed to all kinds of things that I didn't know I was voting for because I just didn't know what I was doing. I've been here 14 years and 2 months. I don't succumb so easy now to the things that, it's just conformity. Oh, you have to do this. The feds come. You know, we've had staff come tell us about technology. I don't know technology. My 14-year-old helps me. I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, it's like, ooh, kind of fun. But so when the department comes up and they're going to tell us you have to do all this stuff to make it comply to the ACA, which is 2,000 pages long, and all the regs are another 10,000 pages or whatever, I don't know that. I got to take their word for it. And if this is going to be a consumer panel of people who don't know acronyms, who don't know the technology, and it's like a good housekeeping seal, people sitting around and Mother Teresa and her friends sitting, oh, what do you think we should do? That's naive, and it's not going to work. And we have good staff here. My best work I've done here in my time has been when I took a department bill, I said, no, we're not doing that. That's not a good idea. I know that you are a great department, but you're wrong here. I know topics about people. I know citizens. I know providers who are going to be hurt by this idea you thought was such a great idea. So I can speak back. And maybe they'll listen to their advisors. But we're the board now, okay? And all these people here are advisors. And like, okay, well, thanks, and I'm kind of tired. I didn't listen all the way, or I don't like that guy, or he's not persuasive to me. That message won't get through into the operational stuff. And my idea, I don't get to write this bill, but to make it work, you want seven people who have some operational knowledge of the system, and they'll be somewhat biased. We all are. I'm a consumer. I'm a provider. I'm a legislator. I'm a business owner. I'm conflicted. And each of us have conflicts as well. And, you know, don't buy my deal. This will make it work better. This would make it work better. But at least if you have a provider on there, let them be providing. You know, let them be in the active business of providing. I can't tell you how often I've run into academics who don't know anything about the real world. And bless academics. But there's something about the day-to-day grind, getting up every day, seeing patients, or living with the effects of the health plans and payment and current events that make it productive. And so I beg you, as you consider my ideas, we're now getting on to the real discussions, and about the ideas of the business community, and even the easiest one here that you've been given about have a real provider on, take that, please. But I'm cautioning you, this is going to go forward. And October 1st, the button has to get pushed. It's got to start. And if the people don't know the acronyms on this board, and they're thinking, oh, it shouldn't be this way, and they have an idea that they have to be persuaded by everything and learn everything, it's going to be really hard. And what's going to happen then is this good staff group, they're going to run the thing. Non-elected or non-ratified, good people, but when that's what happens with boards. I've been on boards before, and I would walk in, and here's a staff report. Okay, we'll just do that. So I'm just cautioning you about what would happen. So it's your call. I only got one vote out of 10. Anyway, I'll stop, Mr. Chair. Thank you,
Representative Abler and Senator Hayden.
You know, I was compelled to just kind of listen for a long time to try to figure out kind of the rationale one way or another. And I was thinking about, you know, I've been here four years and a couple months, and I kind of walked in the door and met Jim and our Representative Abler and others, and I knew a lot about, you know, human service and how it worked, but not a lot about this stuff, and but there were a lot of great people around me that helped me to start understanding how it worked. But I did understand the concepts of what I was trying to do and what I wanted to do. And so as I started to continue to learn, I was amazed at the capacity and how fast I could pick up on these issues. And I was amazed on just how my instincts asked a question like, tell me, you know, how much, if we pay you, insurance company, how much of that money goes to the provider? And then I was stunned when no one could answer that question, right? And then we know how that played out, and I'm not trying to go after insurance companies here. I'm just trying to tell you that that was a question I asked the first week that I was on a committee in this legislature, and 4 years later, we started to understand that we probably should have answered that question then, because when we did answer the question, the state saved a whole bunch of money. And the reason why I say that, in Representative Abler and others, is I'm not quite sure that I needed to have a PhD or an MD or a JD when I walked in the door to start understanding what my charge and task was and to ask the right questions to try to get at where I want to go. I look at Senator Lori, you know, and I don't want to offend anybody, but the way that he understood the bill, right? Well, I mean, I was just going to say, you know, I was going to talk about Rain Man, but then I also know that that might be offensive to him and others that may have some version of autism, but the way that he understood the bill, the way that he was able to sit for 12 hours and almost answer line by line, provision by provision, and I know that Ms. Weeks and others had a hand in that, was amazing to me. The last time I looked, Senator Lori's not a doctor. He's not. He doesn't have an MD behind his name. He's a very smart, competent, capable senator who really understands how this works. In the same token, Representative Atkins didn't have to go so long, but he also understands this bill, and he's not a doctor either. He's not a healthcare professional. I'm not saying that healthcare professionals shouldn't be a part of this, and we can talk about how that works in terms of getting people who understand this to be on this board and figure that out. I just don't find it to be a prerequisite. And I don't find that if a practicing physician or a healthcare professional doesn't get on this board, that all of a sudden they're just going to look and they're just going to shrug their responsibility, listen to whoever, and push buttons and say yes or no, and the next thing you know, we're going down. I think that there's a theme that I often hear, and maybe I'm just a tad too optimistic, but I think that the people that we pick on this board are going to be highly competent and capable individuals who are going to seek the advice that they need, that are going to talk to the staff. We're going to have advisory boards from consumers to industry players that they're going to talk to. I've been impressed with Ms. Malnov and others that really understand this. And I just think that we have to be really clear the message that we're sending to the public about conflict of interest, the message that we're sending to the public that we're going to have the best exchange that we have, and we're not going to let all of these kind of folks who may have an interest, excuse me, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought a little bit, but I guess you understand where I'm going, is that I'm not sure that I buy in. With that being the case, following kind of your logic, Representative Abler, then every single member of the board should be a healthcare professional, because they would understand all the acronyms. They would just hit the ground running and we would be okay. Well, I just don't think that one person is going to change that no more than seven. But the message that it sends, that we may have people who actively have that may actively have a conflict of interest when they're making those decisions, I think it's tough. And I can't figure out when they would have an opportunity to talk about issues and not recuse themselves. And maybe there is, because I'm not, but it just seems like they'd be recusing themselves half the time, because the issues that we deal with would directly affect the work that they do. So I'm not necessarily saying we shouldn't take a little deeper dive and kind of figure out if we can craft and figure out how to get someone there. I just don't necessarily buy the argument that having a practicing healthcare professional is going to exponentially make this board better, and that we then now know that, okay, we have that healthcare professional, we should all rest easy, because anything that the board doesn't know, you just turn to that healthcare professional and they'll explain it. I'm just not quite sure that I buy that argument, though, you know, I think that this is why we have these conversations. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm just not sure.
And Representative Huntley, Schoen, and then Senator Lurie, and then we're going to try to wrap our heads around it.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, you know, this is a board of seven individuals, but it's not going to be a board where they all come in there at their monthly meeting or weekly meeting or daily meeting and are just seven individuals. Over a period of time, they interact with each other and they become part of an organization. And one of the more moving things that ever happened to me in this area was probably 15 years ago, and I'll even use his name, but Doug Wood was a cardiologist for Mayo. And we're sitting there, and I had been interacting with him for probably a year, so I knew who he was and how he thought. And he was trying to explain to this board I was on with him. Most of us were not professional MDs or whatnot. He happened to be one. And he was trying to explain to us the payment system in healthcare and what DRGs meant and how they were organized, where they came from, and what they meant. And we kept asking him questions because most of us were amateurs, and I don't think we would get that interaction if you just brought an expert in to testify to the board, because we knew this guy. And finally he said he understood that we were not being able to follow what he was telling us. And he said, and I'll never forget this, he said, let me put it this way about DRGs. He said, I get paid four times as much money per hour to put a stent in somebody as I get paid per hour to prevent that person from needing a stent. And that just completely opened up my eyes about the healthcare payment system and what was wrong with it. And I don't think you would get that if you just brought somebody in as an expert to testify to your committee and they're sitting there and you don't know who they are. And all they're doing is giving you their standard academic kind of views. So if you know these people as individuals, it makes a huge amount of difference in the impact that they can have on other members of the board. And it's not related. I mean, here's a guy that's actually talking against his own interest. He's better off putting stints in people because he makes four times as much per hour as he does doing the other stuff. And unless you have that personal interaction that's going to happen on a board, because, as I said, there's not just seven individuals that come in there completely independent day after day. They become part of an organization. And it's you learn who you can trust and who you can't trust.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, could you provide me an example? And this is not to be in conflict with your statement. I'm just curious what you think during your practice would present a conflict if someone in your shoes was on the board. And, you know, or you're a rural provider out in Wilmer, Minnesota, at Affiliated Community Medical Center providing family practice services. What maybe would be an example of a conflict that would arise?
Senator Sharon?
Well, you have to think about me as a practitioner coming out of a model of thought about healthcare and how it ought to be, how it ought to function, and how it ought to be reimbursed. And those decisions influence my profession. And either allow it to practice unfettered and freely or not. So it doesn't make any difference where you practice in the state. That's true. So I am also concerned about being able to maintain controls over that practice. It is my income. It is where it is that I am going to earn income. I understand what Representative Hunnelly said about the DRGs, and I understand about the process of getting to grasp how volume and choosing the high-cost procedures, you know, sort of, it's sort of the same concept of wanting to make sure that the insurance industry doesn't cherry-pick which client you have, because one earns you more money than another based on how much it costs or how much you can make off of that client. So I have that frame of reference coming forward, and I'm thinking about, if I were on the board, I'd be thinking about how to make certain that the reimbursement system that comes through the this is a little strong. I wouldn't necessarily be this pecuniary in my thinking, but I couldn't help but have that filter when something comes up, understand how is this going to affect my practice? How is it and my colleagues' practice? And my sense that my colleagues are going to have a voice on this table, my professional voice on this table for decision making. And that's what I'm there about, rather than about an insurance exchange. This to be designed to create a marketplace for people to have access to options for how to cover their health care. That isn't going to change any place. And I want the consumer to have confidence that in this board, that the decisions about that are being made on the best interests of me as a buyer of the product, not as a person who is selling the product or a person whose entire income is dependent often on what the decisions are made for what is in that product.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Representative Schoen? Representative Goodwin, did you have a anybody that thinks the fix is in when you get to a conference committee, I think is just figured out, because we've got bipartisan opposition and bicameral opposition, and from both, it really is kind of neat to see. It might drive folks nuts to think we should have a preordained outcome before we walk in here, and it should all be scripted, but it obviously isn't. So, Representative Goodwin, or Senator Goodwin,
Mr.
I'm still used to serving you in the House.
You call me whatever you want. Most people do. But Mr. Chair, on that point, I think it's because, you know, we have two chairs that are doing an excellent job of running this conference committee, too, I don't want to hold us up, but I do want to just talk about Representative Huntley's point. I don't see why people that have just been out of practice for a year, if Dr. Wood would have been out of practice for a year, you still would have respected his opinion and would have definitely, he could have definitely explained the same kinds of things to you that he did being in practice. So that's my concern. Another concern is that if you have one expert on the board from any field, I think Senator Sharon said it well, that they're going to be protecting their field as long as that's a field that they're still getting paid in. But also that my concern is that the other people on the board will defer to that person because they are in practice. And it might, depending on the person, I've also been on boards, and I've studied social interaction, and that's what my degree is in. And I can tell you that what's going to happen there is that they are going to have a tendency to defer to that one person that's still in practice. And I don't want those decisions influenced by somebody that is currently practicing and able to still get paid for the field. None of us can help it, but be interested and be a little bit, at least a little bit, pushed by what we know, what we're an expert in, and have that particular opinion be very important and push that opinion harder. So I really think that we can get the same expertise out of people that have been out of the field for a year.
Thank you, Senator. Let's go to Representative Liebling and then Senator Lurie.
Okay, I just
Liebling.
Thought everybody was speaking on this, so I thought maybe I should. Mr. Chairman.
I just wanted to respond to
Representative Huntley's example and say I just learned that story from him. I didn't need to have Dr. Wood sitting here.
Oh, that's true.
So, you know, I think it's I would much prefer to keep as much as I like practitioners, and I do, and they bring a lot, I really don't think that you have to have them sitting next to you on the board to get the richness of what they would bring. And the same thing with insurance folks and the same thing with everybody else. And I'm sorry I walked in while Senator Hayden was speaking, but I think he and I are twins separated at birth because I think what he was saying really accurately reflects my opinion, which is that we all do this all the time, and we are not necessarily the expert in that field, and yet we listen, we come together, we discuss like we're doing now, we hear the story that somebody else heard, and we do our best. So that's my feeling about this.
Senator Lurie.
A couple of points. First off, I think it's important that in this conversation to be clear always that we're not actually putting a practitioner on this board. We're saying that there may be a scenario where a practitioner might meet one of the other criteria and be the best person with the best makeup to sit on this board if we move something on the conflict of interest. That's an important aspect to keep in consideration. And let's tease out Dr. Wood, a friend of mine as well. I was there at the meeting and was also struck when he finally put it in terms that we could all understand and do think that we could engage in that with him not on the board. But to go to Senator Goodwin's point about, you know, somebody such as a Dr. Wood could serve if they were retired for a year, this gets back to my point. Let's tease that out. I mean, Dr. Wood and folks like him, they're not going to actually retire. They're going to keep their license. They're going to keep privileges somewhere and maintain a couple of clients that they've had through their entire practice. That's how they operate. It's not like other parts of the industry where you just actually walk away and have that year to resolve the conflict of interest. And so to get somebody who's, you know, practically retired but still maintaining a couple of patients. I mean, a Dr. Wood, you know, he's going to – the tip – I don't know that he will. Maybe he will disappear to Florida and golf. I don't get the sense that that's terribly likely. But that's the way that profession works. And I've been made amenable to this, you know, through discussion. And so – you know, again, I think Representative Atkins is right. We've had a really good conversation about this. It doesn't feel like it's going as well for me on the Senate side as the House side. But we're, you know, I
might weigh in.
You kicked us.
Yeah. But you know what, Senator? I mean, this is what it's about. This is and when we talked about this as just a potential idea a couple mm-hmm. days ago, we didn't have the answer. If we did, we would have came in with a solid recommendation and said, "Here's what we." To me, this is I consider it a very fine line back and forth. And I actually read the language again as we were sitting here, and the point that you made, Senator, is an important one. Is nothing requires the governor to appoint a provider. It would simply say that if there is a provider that's appointed, that they would have to they'd be subject to the recusal standard. And I think at this point, unless, you know, and both sides have listened very respectfully to the other and we've had questions back and forth, perhaps the best thing to do is just simply test it by motion. We've got other issues that are going to bear out lots of discussion later. But, Senator, as I understood what you wanted the Senate language on.
I'll make the motion I suggested earlier and see how it flies. I move House Section 5, Subdivision 4, incorporating an oral amendment to strike on line 534, institutional health care provider or and strike on line 535, other entity providing health care, comma. And then, you know, after that, I would also, we'll take that motion separately, but just to let people understand, I would also be wanting to pick up the Senate language extending these conflicts to close family members. But the motion would include this conflict. It would remove it from the health care providers, and it would include the strong recusal language that the House developed, and that would be my motion.
And then just so people are clear on the House language, the other difference that we had in there was that we said no lobbyists would be allowed on the, those are the folks that are referenced in Section 10A.01 on line 6.2. That was also in the House language. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No. No.
The motion prevails. And then, Senator, you had you referenced on the Senate language on line 6.10 to 6.12. Are you moving? Senator Lori moves the Senate language on 6.10 to 6.12. Is there discussion of that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? That motion prevails. We had a couple issues. Senator Hayden, don't run away, buddy. This is one of yours.
I got a bill. I was just. Can we just can you move it around really
quick? No, we'll come back to you. This is. Wanted to come back on that advisory.
I do want to talk about this.
We want to do it while you were here.
Yeah, I'm thinking we're out of time if I don't get over there.
We had language brought to us that has been run by Senator Lori as well. And I'm just trying to take some of the items that have been left open. We've addressed the conflict of interest. We've got what Representative Liebling and Senator Hayden were talking about last night for out-of-pocket reimbursement for advisory group members. We've got some language that I believe Mr. Shepard may have done, or Mr. Pender on the Representative Liebling. You raised some concern about the gun ownership issue and how that was phrased kind of backwards. So, Representative or Mr. Pender, Mr. Chun, I don't know who had to. All right, Ms. Kavanaugh's got an amendment to try to address that, Representative Liebling. And I'll read it to you as it's being passed out. It just says there'd be a subdivision, gun and firearm ownership. The Minnesota insurance marketplace shall not collect information that indicates whether or not an individual owns a gun or has a firearm in the individual's home.
Yeah, I'll.
The language that we were talking about last night sort of presupposed that we already had that information and we wouldn't share it with anybody. Representative Liebling, do you want to speak to that concern you had last evening?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, yeah, the concern that I had was the way the House language was phrased. It made it sound like the exchange was collecting it but wasn't allowed to share this information, which, of course, is not the case. The exchange is not going to collect this. The only concern I have with this language as drafted is that it, again, it kind of implies by leaving it out that other information is collected. And I was hoping we'd have a more comprehensive piece of language that I think Representative Huntley showed me last night, excuse me, that referenced the fact that we're not collecting health information either. There's a lot that the exchange is not collecting, and this is a concern for a lot of people. It was expressed through a lot of the committee hearings by people who naturally worry about the privacy of their health information. And so, Mr. Chair, while I really appreciate this, I think this is definitely a step in the right direction. I would much prefer to see a little more comprehensive language that reassures everybody about the information that the marketplace is not collecting. So I think singling out gun and firearm ownership even in this way somehow suggests that there's other information that's being collected when, in fact, it is not.
Fair enough.
So close.
And Representative Liebling, we may have additional language as the day goes on. What I wanted to at least address, so were some of the, I think it's fine to address it here And then as far as this particular issue, and then as we go on, we may have some additional language that's being developed for us that'll capture the larger issue as well that you raised. With that, though, Senator Lori will move the A-112 amendment. Is there additional discussion?
Just a technical one. Did we adopt 17.9 to 11 yesterday?
17.9 to 11.
That's the original language. Did we adopt that as part of that whole section? And we'd have to delete it, is all. But do you remember?
It's on the R-23, right?
And I have, Representative Abler, I've drawn a line on my copy through the words. Well, I can't even read them anymore.
Oh, the tobacco thing. But if we adopted that, we'll have to just delete that and then add this language is all. It's just a technical.
I don't think we did.
And
I think we adopted the whole section.
I thought we adopted it and said we'd come back. Was my recollection?
Also, we have to amend the motion to
Mr.
delete.
Chair.
Thank you, Senator Lori. Representative Abler.
Oh, you have to just amend the motion to delete 17.9 to 11. That's all.
So my motion on the A-112 amendment would be that the language incorporated on the A-112 amendment be incorporated in the adoption of House line 17.9 to 17.11 that was included in the conference committee work in progress, whatever we call that, yesterday.
Is staff and members clear as to that?
They know what we're talking about.
Ms. Kavanaugh is nodding for the record. Is there further discussion of that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? That prevails. The motion is adopted. Senator Hayden, welcome back. That
was
the quickest bill hearing I've ever
seen.
Well,
they went on without me, so Mr. Chair, so I'll be running again, but that's how it works around.
Well, let's take a shot at. We had a discussion last night about out-of-pocket compensation or per diem for those members of advisory groups, and I just wanted to make sure, Senator Hayden and Representative Liebling, because you guys were concerned about it, we've got an amendment coming to you. I'll read it. Again, I hate to have people always scrambling to go and grab the language, but what it says is the board may provide compensation and expense reimbursement under Section 15.059, Subdivision 3, to members of the advisory committees. And are there questions? The amendment is being passed out, Senator Lori then will move the A-111 amendment for purposes of further discussion. Senator Lori?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I will move that amendment, but in discussions with staff and legislative staff and exchange staff, I think that this is already in law and doesn't need to be restated in the A-111 amendment. I think that as we dug into it further, they actually do have the ability to pay these advisory committees as it stands without adopting this amendment, but I think still moving it would be fine and do no harm. But that is my understanding. Maybe staff could confirm that.
Ms. Kavanaugh, that. You want to speak to that?
And you're not supposed
Mr.
to
Chair
spin those
and
members,
microphones, remember?
I know. They were speaking to me when they said that. That's true. I mean, in law, the board would have the ability. I suppose you could change the may to a shall if you want to require them to do it, but they now have that option to do that currently under 15.059 because it's an advisory committee, and just like every other advisory committee and boards and whatnot, that they would have compensation and expense reimbursement, which I believe is like $55 a day plus expenses.
Thank you, Ms. Kavanaugh.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden and then Representative Liebling. Senator Hayden.
So I guess my concern is that often when we start this process, we just had a very long debate about kind of the expertise that goes on the actual board and these very high paid, very high skilled professionals that go on to try to help us think about what we should do. But often what I find around here is that the people who we're doing it to often don't get a voice. And so, the reason why I wanted to bring this up, and this really teases out kind of a larger issue as we talk about, and I talked to Ms. Malnoff about this implementation and rollout and how do we kind of get to communities, to all Minnesotans, especially those that are dealing, that typically don't have access to these boards, the opportunity to make sure that when we do recruit, that the consumers that we recruit to the board in particular have some way to cover a little bit of their cost when they're spending time advising this board. And if they don't have the ability to cover even their ability to get over here, I'm talking about people who might be on Metro Transit or others, to be able to get over here and interact with us and say this will work or this won't work for me. I think that voice is as important as those that are kind of at the high level architects designing this. Many of us know that we if we've ever built a house or remodeled, what the architect said that they want doesn't always work with our budget, or it may not work the functionality of it may not work. So what I just want to ensure, if this is not, I mean, if we put this on, I think that's great. If we don't put it on and we leave it to staff, I really need to get a commitment from our staff that we will kind of do that kind of outreach. We will ensure to the best of our ability that we are making the accommodations that are necessary to make sure that all voices are heard. So I think the compensation really just speaks to a larger theme around ensuring that we just don't get kind of a bunch of folks who have a little spare time on their hands who want to come over and kind of give us some advice, that we're actually targeting communities that often don't have a voice in this process, that they have a voice. And I think that sometimes those of us that if we don't live in their shoes, it may seem like a bus ride over here or per diem for their babysitter or taking a couple of hours off of work but they get paid an hourly wage and not on salary, and they don't have vacation. All of those things are to us sometimes just like, well, I don't, what's the big deal? But to that group that I think we really need to make sure that we hear from, it makes a big difference. And if we don't have some sort of compensation, they may not want to participate.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what he said, and in addition, Greater Minnesota, people coming from farther away. But what I really wanted to ask is I just wanted to make sure how this is working. We've got the section C here, and it says section 15.0597 shall not apply. And I just wanted to ask staff what that is to make sure that this is what
Mr.
This
Chair
is doing
and
together.
Members, that's the expiration language, and that's the typical expiration language that's in chapter 15.
Okay, thank you. Well, I have the... As I said, I really have the same concern as Senator Hayden, and I think this language takes care of it, but I just would hope that this board would take this seriously and, you know, talking about having somebody at the table that you want to hear from, and at least this gets them at least to the advisory table, and I do think that's very important.
Not quite yet. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Is there other discussion? The amendments before us, even if it is, frankly, current law, I think with the emphasis that's been on it, I don't see any reason not to place it in the language of the bill. So unless there's objection to that, all in favor of the A-111 amendment, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. The language is adopted. We had, and I'll ask that this be passed out as well, we've got an amendment that was brought to us. We've referenced, making sure that the issues relative to the tribes here in Minnesota are addressed. Mr. Haas approached Senator Laurie and I. I'll read the language so that members know what it is and members of the public. It simply says the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace shall comply with all future changes in federal law in regard to health coverage for tribes. And I think that's just a belts and suspenders kind of approach, but it's important that we not leave anybody behind. Senator Laurie will move. Should we label the amendment?
A-1000.
I like that. We now are up to, as Mr. Pender just recommended, we'll call it the A1000 Amendment. That leaves us a little more room to operate in between that and 999. Senator Lori will move the A1000 Amendment, which is the language that I just read. Is there additional discussion or questions relative to that? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. The language is adopted. We get now into some of the more challenging pieces, perhaps, of the bill. There's remaining, as I've got it, are issues like rulemaking, the active selector versus in the House or in the Senate versus what the House has, and the financing. And as we discussed yesterday, the Senate has financing that uses the general fund dollars generated from the tobacco tax. The House uses an approach that would use a premium withhold. The only other lingering issues that I've got on my list were relative to the definition of the website that was referenced yesterday, and then some 60K issues. Are there and
we can move some other.
Hold on for just a moment, please.
Do we have the remember we had the website definition we said we'd come back to?
Yeah.
Do we have
we've got
no, this is the website putting in the definition. And then that
all right, we've got the Ms. Kavanaugh, do we have the definition of the website? We just one of those things as you go through, even with nine committee stops, we realize that we didn't define exactly which website we were referring to. So I think this is another relatively straightforward amendment. Senator Lori will move, and we won't discuss it until the amendment's passed out, but it's the A113 amendment. And again, so folks don't have to scramble to go read it, I'll just read it to you. It says, definition for the website in Subdivision 13 means a site maintained on the World Wide Web by the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace that allows for access to information and services provided by the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace. I can't really imagine that there's going to be significant questions or concerns about it, but if there are, I'd entertain them now. Seeing none, we've got the A113 amendment before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Are there any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. The language is adopted. Then, Ms. Kavanaugh, did we also have the provider? We had one other amendment I thought that was in the drafting stage.
Too many fires and too many parts.
The 60K language.
Yeah, I don't. Does he want to do that? Yeah, okay. Okay, so what it does is it amends this amendment that we adopted last night.
Okay. Members also being passed out. We had 60K is the insurance producer, and we took an amendment last night. In retrospect, Senator Lori wanted to clean up a little bit. It's the MS-038A-1 amendment. And
it's not an exercise.
Ms. Kavanaugh, once members have the amendment, can you explain what the amendment would do, and we'll then let Senator Lori move it when he returns. But Ms. Kavanaugh, can you explain what we did last night and what this language would do relative to the insurance producer language that we adopted last night?
Mr. Chair and members, on the 038 amendment that we adopted last night, there is on page 2, lines 30 to 34, there was a paragraph that talks about the board and the website that are exempt from 60K, and then we added language that said any employee of the marketplace whose primary purpose that rest of that set. That paragraph, what we're doing is we're rewording that paragraph so it would read, the board and the website are exempt from Chapter 60K, period. Any employee of the Minnesota insurance marketplace who sells, solicits, or negotiates insurance to individuals or small employers must be licensed as an insurance producer under Chapter 60K, period.
Thank you. And Senator Laurie, we'll move the MS-038A-1 amendment. Senator, do you want to speak further to it?
I think you
add anything to what Ms. Kavanaugh just said?
I think that described it well.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Laurie. Is there anyone else that has questions? Representative Lieberman.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make sure that we're not inadvertently stepping on the toes of navigators with the negotiates insurance language.
Senator Laurie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, this actually helps, and in no case, in neither instance, the exchange is never going to employ navigators. Those are going to be done through contracts, and this only applies to employees to start with. But the concept of assisting individuals is much broader than the concept of sell, solicit, negotiate. And sell, solicit, negotiate is our historic, well-crafted definition of what falls under 60K. And assist is a less defined, more nebulous term that was difficult to work around, and it had us carrying that other than providing impartial information, which was also not well defined. If we just get rid of assist and impartial information and just go to what we know and what we've always used, this is saying that if you're an employee of the exchange and you're doing the things that have always been licensed under 60K, sell, solicit, negotiate, you need to be licensed. And so this should help get us away from the navigators and make clear that that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions relative to the amendment? If not, the MS-038A-1 amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. The motion carries. The language is adopted. Representative Abler, you told me earlier that, because as I've got it now, we've got active selector and versus guaranteeing certain admission of some plans versus financing
removal from the board is one that Representative Abler
and then removal from the board is
right.
What you
held
would,
on
whichever you would like to discuss first,
and then oversight too of the board,
right? You have.
Well, let's talk about removal. That's easy. I mean, it's how hard could it be? I mean, you've got a tight standard and all that, and you know, I voted for the compromise. I don't know. I hope it gets where you want to get, but you still might get a bad choice through the process. And so, right now, what you have is a board that's accountable to no one except for an oversight committee, which will. Maybe everybody might have not come to the meeting. Their budget is appropriated to them entirely. All the money they get, it's appropriated to them. And even the governor can't remove a person that he wants at this point, and only two-thirds of the peers, so four out of the six, I suppose, would have to be voting to remove a person, which is hard to do. And I'm concerned about that. Is anybody else concerned about that? And if they are, what should we do? And if it's only me, I think it's going to be 1-9, and that's going to be the end of it. But I think there should be a mechanism by which somebody gets to remove them. And I think it should be the governor. At least there'd be a final check on the balance. So that's my thought about removal.
When we have, some for cause removal language in the bill. I should have pulled it up before we started.
Mr. Chair, it's only by 2/3 vote of their peers for cause.
So, Representative Abler, your proposal would be that the governor would be able to unilaterally remove someone?
And you could say for cause, just not whimsically, but they would not do it, but for some reason that was a pretty important one. But that gives another balance. So that's my thinking.
Okay. Members, thoughts? Representative Liebling and then Senator Laurie. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think that I'm not opposed to what Representative Abler is suggesting in terms of having some additional balance. I don't think that having the governor just be able to remove somebody is a good idea. It really makes it too political. And you could have somebody who's, sometimes the best people are the ones who kind of go out there on a limb and take a chance. And you don't want just a governor. He's just, he or she, after all, is just one person and responding to political pressures and so on. So I don't think that's a mechanism that I would support. But I do kind of take the point that it is very hard to get somebody's peers on a small board to call them out and want to remove them. But I don't know that we've hit on a mechanism here for that. And I think you want to have it be something where it's something well beyond somebody having an unpopular opinion.
Right.
And I don't know what, I don't have a mechanism for that, Representative Abler, but I don't support the one you've mentioned.
Yeah.
Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, Representative Abler, we did have some discussions about this, mostly offline in the Senate, and I had a lot of the same concerns about, potential future governor coming in and for any reason removing this board, and I was very reluctant to give that authority. And Representative Abler, he said, well, we could add for cause. That's not like just a little, well, maybe. That's actually, again, very well defined in statute and very well and in case law. And I've looked into it, and typically when we do have these boards, we do give the appointing authority the ability to remove for cause. And that's actually not just a little throwaway clause. That's a very, very meaningful clause. And, it's still not without some hesitation that I say this, but I have in looking at how that's been used in case law and in other boards. I do believe that for cause is well enough defined that I could support an amendment where we allowed the appointing authority to remove for cause.
Other thoughts on that? Representative Abler, do you have that amendment drafted?
No, I don't. And maybe if I could ask Ms. Cavanaugh to draft something. I just was bringing up the topic. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, rather than doing this quickly, unless Ms. Cavanaugh is very comfortable, we do have an amendment over in the Senate that I was actually prepared to take, but it didn't get offered. Oh. I don't know why, but maybe we could have some time and get back to that. Given the fact that you said that yesterday, I should have done a little bit more work overnight, but dug that up. But I do have it in my office somewhere.
Short nap, anyway.
And so maybe we can.
Good.
Hold, unless you want to,
Mr. Chair,
have some time to look up that,
Senator Hayden, and then
can wait.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, Mr. Chair, what's the precedence for this? What do we do for the MAC, or what do we do for the PUC? I guess sometimes I just want to see if what's our practice around here when the appointing authority does, what is our practice? What do we do when the other boards and commissions, especially the larger ones in this case, does the board have the authority, or does the appointing authority have the authority? And I think that would help guide me along this process, even though I know that the Exchange Commission is new and very large.
And Senator Lurie?
Chair, Senator Hayden, it is pretty typical that the appointing authority have the ability. PUC, and in most of these cases, the appointing authority really does have the ability to remove for cause. And cause is well understood in our case law. Absence from three meetings, dereliction of duty. We specifically say in here that a conflict of interest is cause for removal, and so if a conflict were to arise during an individual service,
That would be cause, but it is pretty well refined. They couldn't go in and remove because of a an opinion expressed or any of the concerns that Representative Liebling expressed earlier. So I'm not wedded to taking it. It does still cause me some discomfort, but I do believe that that is the typical practice that we've used in other boards, and I've looked into it personally and do believe that appointing authority removal for cause would be something that would still give us assurance that, you know, it would only be for, you know, a legitimate failure to behave in a manner consistent with the direction of this board that that the governor would have then the ability to go in and remove members.
And Representative Abler, before we go back to you, Ms. Kavanaugh, are you prepared to, we could do it later, but if you're prepared to offer or provide language now that would satisfy the direction, we'll bring it up as a motion and then test it out.
Mr. Chair and members, let's try this. On R7,
I can introduce
the House language, and we're looking at 6.20 to 622, the removal language. If on 6.20 we delete board and say appointing authority, and on 6.21 delete and a two-thirds vote of the board, and put a period, and then we put an and after notice, so it would read, a board member may be removed by the appointing authority only for cause following notice and hearing, period. And then we keep that last sentence, a conflict of interest as defined in subdivision 4 shall be cause for removal from the board.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And Ms. Kavanaugh just came over and asked me about that, and as she walked away, I thought, we have to, this allows the governor to remove somebody, but maybe you still want to let the board be removing somebody if they would choose, because they might find this person embarrassing. And I know a school board up in my neck of the woods kicked out a person. I think it was, if it was someplace north of me, I forget what city now. So you might want to keep both, and I'm not,
and Representative,
that's even better. Yeah.
I actually, as I thought more about this, and you were nice enough to share with me the both yesterday and previously, I'm actually more comfortable with it as Ms. Kavanaugh just.
Oh.
And the reason I am is because let's say that you've got an unpopular member who doesn't necessarily vote with the majority. You know, it isn't doing anything wrong. It's just that the majority doesn't kind of like her or like him. And I just thought as we, you know, even though went through, there wasn't a great deal of conversation in the House. I don't believe there was a lot in the Senate. And to give the appointing authority for cause, which is a term of art, it's one that we understand, the ability to remove that person, I think that's a heck of a lot better than giving their peers, who might just happen to disagree with him or her a lot, the ability to remove that person. So I'm actually more comfortable keeping it this way. But that would be my perspective, Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, is it clear enough what notice and hearing would be, hearing before whom, and when you've got this now? I had assumed the way it was before that it was sort of a hearing before the board itself, since that's who would be voting. But now that that would be out under this proposal, who would be given the notice and who would be doing the hearing?
My suggestion would be that we, because of the fact, as Senator Hayden referenced, we've got this sort of approach with lots of other boards across Minnesota, is to mirror it along those lines, which I don't believe talks about notice and hearing. It talks about that it's got to be for cause. That the appointing
notice and hearing, if you just
use those words. And they, Ms. Kavanaugh corrects me. She says they do use notice and hearing, but they simply, I would suggest that we mirror it up, that we put the language on. If there's more cleanup that we can do, but my sense is that that's what we've done with other boards across Minnesota, and that is perhaps the best way to go. Senator Laurie.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd prefer to just hold on it until we had the right
language
myself and just look at it. We had language mirrored after the PUC and things, and I think this is a big enough deal that we should. The oral amendment is what we had. Okay. Well, if that's Ms. Kavanaugh corrects me as well, that the oral amendment is what we had and what we worked on and would then mirror the PUC. So with that, I'd be comfortable moving that oral amendment.
All right. So Senator Laurie moves the oral amendment. Representative Liebling?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, and Senator Laurie, I'm fine with the oral amendment. I just do have that question about who gives the notice and who does the hearing. And maybe it's something that's already kind of a known thing here, but maybe staff could just tell me then under this. We could clean it up later and add that or something. I just want to make sure it gets dealt with so it's not hanging out there.
And Representative Liebling, we'll come back with more information on what the past practice is in other areas, but this is the language that we've got to use that's used in other areas. Is there further discussion of the oral amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries. The language is adopted. Senator Laurie.
Representative Atkins, Mr. Chair, say in the data discussion that we had yesterday, there was one provision that came in an amendment on the Senate floor that I would like to try to have included in here. And so maybe I'll just make the motion. It's on page R21, and then we can open it up for discussion. The last sentence of paragraph B there on Senate lines 15.6 and 15.7, no personal medical data can be shared under this section. That's an amendment we took on in the Senate.
And Senator Laurie moves
adoption of line 15.6 of Senate language on the R21, no personal medical data can be shared, and line 15.7 under this section, period.
And thank you, Senator Laurie. That motion is before us. On behalf of the House, we had Representative, and I appreciate the spirit in which the motion is made and that you're defending Senate language, but there is perhaps nothing that the House feels as strongly about as the effort that was made in protection of private data and the works of Representative Holberg, Representative Simon, Representative Scott. They literally spent hours, Senator, on making sure that we crafted just as good as we possibly could the data practices and privacy language. And I, frankly, do not want to mess with those efforts. I think even among senators, when we talk about that bipartisan group on issues like data practices and protecting private data, everybody regards them as for their expertise. And to the extent that we change any language, I'm just afraid that when you mess with it a little, it has an impact in other places. So just speaking for myself, and I hope my fellow House conferees at least, and perhaps your members as well, that I could not support that, and I think it might actually have some really bad unintended consequences, even though we all want to protect data. So could I say it more strongly than that, Senator? It's just not something I'm comfortable messing with. Other comments, members?
Mr. Chair, what specific section are we discussing?
This is in data.
Right.
It's on the R21, page R21, the last sentence of paragraph B of the Senate language.
And you will recall, Representative Abler, we took, and thank you to our senators, we took last night several pages of the data practices provisions and privacy protections that were adopted in the House. And this would make a slight change to that I don't know that it's necessarily bad, but I just don't want to mess with something that folks have worked so hard on. I fear that there'd be some kind of, we would actually potentially protect information less by changing what we currently have in the bill now as a result of the adoption of the House language last night. Representative Schoen.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to reaffirm your discussion on that, I mean, every time we turned around, somebody tried to paint a conspiracy theory that, you know, medical providers, as a result of the health insurance exchange, were going to be required to transmit private medical data from their health visit. And I know we worked pretty hard to make sure that that was clear in the data provisions, that that wasn't part of the health insurance exchange process. And I think with those two individuals that we have that work very, very diligently on those issues, that if they came out comfortable in the data pieces, I think we're sitting in a good spot.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schoen. I think we got a pretty good sense, Representative.
Just trying to figure out what sentence. Is it just no personal medical data can be shared? Is that the sentence?
That's the sentence.
All right. And maybe it's comfort language. I don't know. I don't know. But maybe if you're going to shop it back to people or...
I just would rather, with the amount of effort that went in on the House side, hours and hours and hours,
hours.
By the most expert people, I would oppose messing with it. Is there other discussion?
Sorry to be dull, Mr. Chair.
If not, we have the motion before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. No, the motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a question about timing?
Representative Abler, absolutely.
Ibsen Hornstein wants me to go to a hearing now. Not that I have to do what he says, but I... can you just give me an outline of what you plan to do today in terms of time? Are we going to go through a bunch of things for several more hours and take a break or take a break soon or do you have an idea?
Representative Abler, as I understand what we've got before us, we've got until about 11 o'clock this morning. And then we've got members. It's obviously deadline week, so we've got members chairing committees and presenting bills. And we'll come back at the call of the chair. But I would anticipate it probably a 6 p.m. Start. And I'm not seeing anybody with big objections to that.
What time?
Probably a 6 p.m.
My BHP bill is up at 6.
Well, even better. We'll definitely be coming back at 6 p.m.
Senator Sharon and Senator Hayden will be there
with me. Mr. Chair, are we in session
and
at 6
today? You won't have three votes on the Senate side to adopt anything.
Yeah.
That's what we're hoping for.
It'll be
we have session.
Senator Laurie, what's a reasonable time?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock? Yeah.
7.
7?
7.
I chair... Yeah, I have a chair committee that's got, I think, 10 bills in it.
It's probably going to be 8 o'clock. At 11, I would maybe recommend we recess at the call of the chair, get back here as soon as we possibly can, but understanding that we're, in the unfortunate situation where we're, approaching first committee deadline and have a lot of policy items that need to get through committees, many of which are carried by.
Well, look what happened to me last night. So I'm far from me to point fingers at anybody for having a long
try,
day.
And maybe we can get back here.
Could I suggest this?
Absolutely.
Unless we hear otherwise, let's aim for a hard and fast start at 8 o'clock. And to the folks that are carrying gavels around this room, if you could move your committees along, and to those presenting bills this evening, if you can keep your comments
brief. Use the vice chairs.
But unless you hear otherwise, we will, as soon as we'll keep going until 11 o'clock, but we will come back and we'll start at 8. And we've got, obviously, to get this thing on the floor tomorrow in the House, which is our deadline, we've still got some work to do. And I'd like to kind of begin that discussion a little bit now. The remaining pieces, and thank you, everyone, for your comments and efforts on a number of kind of the remaining hanging issues, some of which were kind of challenging this morning. But probing a little bit further, Senator Laurie, on we've got your financing piece and your selector approach, and I think it was spelled out yesterday a little bit that the House prefers
and
not to use general and rules are the three remaining issues that we've got on deck today. You have a well. Let me. Let me. Why don't we start with rules? I think that there's some chance that we may, and. Yeah. And Ms. Kavanaugh, we Senator Laurie and I don't believe in hiding the ball. Senator Laurie and I talked last night about the difference between the House version and the Senate version on the rulemaking, and we had a good strenuous discussion about what might make some sense. And is that you'll recall that the Senate has an expedited, they've got a 21-day rule, and then it gets a little bit more relaxed later on. The House has something that's sort of in between that with a 30-day rule and then 30 days of publication. And the two obviously don't quite match up. So we talked last night. We talked with the staff from the exchange a little bit about just the practical world of opening up a new venture like this. And we tried to at least come up with a recommendation for your consideration this morning. And then we can figure out where to go from there. But Ms. Kavanaugh, can you walk through the amendment for us? And then we'll have some discussion. And actually, I do like to have motions before us. So Senator Laurie will move the A-110.
Yeah.
Ms. Kavanaugh to the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the A-110 amendment does take a little bit of House and Senate language on lines 1 or 1.5 through 1.22. This is for rulemaking that would occur effective upon enactment until January 1, 2015. This is the language that was in the House. You've got 30 days to comment. That I believe it's 30 days after it's published, so it's a 60-day process. And then on 1.23 to 1.24, this is what would happen after January 1, 2015. The board would be required to use the expedited rulemaking process. And then at the end of the amendment, 1.27 till the end, this adds language into the language that was in the Senate that was adopted last night with the Legislative Oversight Committee, that they would then be required to review. The proposed rules would be also submitted to this committee. And if a majority of the committee members wanted further review, then there would be a process that would kick in that would do that. And if the legislature was in session, then the rule wouldn't go into effect until the review and request was satisfied and withdrawn, or the review was approved by law, or the regular session of the legislature adjourned. And if the legislature was not in session when the request came in, then within then the rule would not go into effect until the request had been satisfied and withdrawn, or February 1st occurred, whichever would occur first.
Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Kavanaugh. Senator Laurie?
Yeah, and this, Mr. Chair, this is a mix of House and Senate and a new concept. Members may recall, members of the Senate anyway, that we've had extensive discussions about rulemaking throughout the entire process over in our body, and again had used the very brief period for the first year, and then had gone to our standard expedited rulemaking process, which is typically a six-month process after that first year, after actually January 1st, 2015. We did so because of, serious concerns and commitment to due process, notice opportunity to be heard, meaningful opportunity to present opinions. The House had essentially that very expedited 30 days, 30-30 concept, and it went on, forever, and that's how the board would operate, and that was fairly problematic for us. So we were quite a ways apart in that. What this represents is a compromise where we would use the House's 30-day process for the first 2 years, and then we would still wind up, once things have stabilized, we would still wind up with the expedited rulemaking called for in Chapter 14 of statute for the balance. And then as an additional stopgap that wasn't in either bill, we're actually going to empower, along the lines of Representative Abler's comments, we're actually going to empower the Legislative Oversight Committee that's established to really take a look and make sure that there is some oversight of the rulemaking adopted. And if a majority from both bodies assigned to this Legislative Oversight Committee takes serious issue with the rules that are proposed, they have the ability to slow that down. And so it's, I believe it's a proposal that we have for committee, for the conference committee's consideration. I believe that it is a mix of the House and the Senate in a way that can give us the nimbleness for this board and still the proper oversight and sunshine and due process that we are all committed to making sure that all public processes in the state of Minnesota go through. So, I mean, I think that this represents a pretty decent compromise on a provision that we were a long way apart on. So I'm comfortable moving the A110 amendment.
And members, I'm comfortable with it, but it took me a long time to get to where the Senate wanted to go. And Senator, we don't need to rehash all that Senator Laurie.
This isn't where the Senate wanted to go either.
I'm talking about the piece that goes into effect after the 2 year mark. That is such a convoluted and enduring and long process that it definitely affects, you know, if this is going to be an entrepreneurial kind of venture and be able to react to market conditions, and then you put in a six-month process, by then the market conditions and all the market forces may well have changed three times. But that being said, as we pressed on the exchange folks, that by the time you reach that two-year mark, they should be responsive, they should have the rules in place. And I just didn't want to, you know, let this wash over without saying that, at least speaking for me and I think the House position, we had some real reservations. And Senator Laurie very much strenuously shared with us what an issue this is in the Senate. This is when there's it was a challenge to get there. Senator Metzen, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I just think this is a great compromise, and I really like the subdivision 3, that kind of the backstop where we got to look see, and I think that makes a lot of sense. And I believe that Senator Abler was kind of spearheading that drive, but I think that's a great idea.
That was a key piece of the solution.
Yeah,
Senator.
I agree, and I think it's a good compromise.
Well, are there other comments or questions relative to the amendment? If not, we have the A110 amendment before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. The motion prevails and the language is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
You want to talk about oversight a little bit?
Love to talk about oversight.
Thank you.
We just did oversight, Representative Abler.
Well, no, we have more. Maybe that magic little passer outer could come by here. And I handed it to you, and it happened magically. Mr. Chair, there's we don't have to decide this now. I've got three options here. And these are only in the upper 380s, so it's really not even competitive.
Not even close to 1,000 like
no,
Mr.
No, sorry. I should have. I think I'd like to renumber them 1385, 86, and 87. We're going to set up $136 million biennial budget. And the way the bill is now, the people are appointed and they're conflict-free and all that. But the money is appropriated to the board. Every penny they get is automatically appropriated. Appropriate. They raise $1 million, $1 billion, $1 zillion. It's all appropriated to the board, and they just submit their bill and they get whatever they want. And I think this part has not been worked on a lot, but I suggest one of three options. Call it an agency. It's an agency for the at least for the purposes of budgeting. They would bring their budget request forward to the governor, go through the process, and have a budget that would be brought in the pages, and then would be put through the process, or put them under Commerce. I just picked Commerce to help out Mr. Pollard. Is he here? He was begging me, not an MMB. And I'm open to amendments to any other agency you want, that they would, admin or not HHS, but somewhere, that they would come as part of that process. So they'd be under some agency of your choice. I just picked Commerce. And they would go through that process. Or they, at least they would go under the, they'd have to report to the governor directly. And have the governor could say, no, we're not wasting all this money on foolish things. And just to guard against any tricksmanship that might happen, the last sentence or so talks about ongoing appropriations at last year's number plus enrollment growth. So there'd be no way to do trickery in future years to use this as a way to undo the budget, because I don't have any interest in causing harm to this. But I do think it should be overseen, and they should come and argue for their budgets and defend why they need 16 more FTEs like Commerce and Human Services and all the other agencies have. So I present those three for your discussion, and I hope you pick one of them. And I don't, it's just where the will of the committee is, but I think somebody needs to watch this, this entity.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Is there questions or comments from members?
Chairman, maybe just
Senator Metzen,
because this is all insurance. Probably the Commerce Department would probably be a better stop than M&M.
All right,
I don't. It's not a big deal with me, but
one of those is the Commerce one.
Oh, is that? Oh, you get that? Oh, okay. I didn't. Okay, but thank you. I didn't see the A, Mr. Chairman, A 386.
That'd be the A 36. The 386 is okay. Okay.
Senator Laurie, and then I have a comment as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, you know, these are also pretty familiar language. Came up many, many times during our nine committee stops. Came up many, many times on the Senate floor. And the Senate has a pretty strong position that we not subject the board to the, you know, biennial appropriation process that would yield much less certainty about how they would be able to function in this critical role, and actually could result in not meeting the ACA requirements that an exchange be self-sustaining by 2015. That is a core ACA requirement, and if we submit them to and introduce that uncertainty in whether they're going to be able to operate at all in every biennial process, we're, you know, I believe, likely at least skirting the edge of that and actually putting it at risk and making them very unable to really fulfill their mission. And so, you know, I would oppose this amendment, and I think that the Senate would have significant issues were we to adopt any one of these three. And they're all similar to what we've seen before and been consistently in opposition to in the Senate process.
And the only comment that I would make is we don't have a House position. I appreciate Representative Ayler being creative and thoughtful in his approach and in bringing ideas. We had, I believe the amendment was offered, Representative Abler, at one committee stop. It did not
on
go
on. On the floor,
on,
and I withdrew it.
And it was withdrawn. And so that's just so people know where the position of the House is. And there's, Representative Abler, my sense was that we address this now in a number of ways, as, you know, not the least of which is the required audit by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And now, as of last night, the adoption of the Senate language for the Oversight Commission of composed of legislators, not to mention the fact that a lot of things have to go through MMB to the legislative else, whatever, what do we call it, the LAC, LCC, and in addition to the practical concerns raised by Senator Laurie. That all being said, is I appreciate the spirit in which this was brought and the needed review by members of the legislature. I'm just hoping that in the other pieces of this bill, which are significant, that we will have accomplished that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I think we're making an error. There is no other unit of government that has no oversight of this much money and this many people, not just the $138 million they're going to be spending in a biennium, which is a lot of money. The commerce budget, I think, is one-third of that or something. Right now, and you scrutinize that, we look at our DHS budgets, we look at the Department of Health. We did 3 and 4% reductions in lean times, told them to get more effective. And right now, there is no mechanism by which that can be overseen. To represent Lori's, Senator Lori's concern, it's such a compliment. We just welcome to our group. To represent Senator Lori's concerns, put some language in to make sure that this doesn't get in the way of implementation. This is not any derailing effort whatsoever. And there may have been people bringing this forward before who had different motives, and I'm not going to question who it was or I didn't watch all your debates. This is not about that. When I chatted with the governor about this last week, he seemed open to it. I don't see any letter from him saying, oh, I'd like this. I wish he had a letter of some kind here advising us on this biggest thing in 50 years we're doing in health care. But I think there's going to be a bill coming sometime, and there's going to be a scandal. Mike Hatch spent some time looking at the health plans. Part of why they're in disrepute here is because of 20 years ago stuff. That's all been fixed. And we're worried about them. Now you got 7 people that are appointed. At least the governor can kick them out if they're for cause. But it's a high bar. No one's ever getting kicked off of this board. And no one's going to look at what they're doing. And they could buy nice chairs. They could go on planning trips. Then maybe they won't. But no one's stopping them from doing that. No one's stopping them from buying newer computers and fancier things because they just are necessary because the staff will say, oh, we need these widgets. And there is not an example in state government of a board like this where they are not overseen. And that's why I gave you 3 choices. I don't care which one you pick, but at least the governor would be interested in having this go forward. And so, you know, I didn't offer one. I'm not moving one right now, but I hope before the day is over that you think about some check and balance on the money. $138 million. You're going to do budgeting pretty quick. And I don't think it should cost this much money in the first place. I wish I could write the bill and scrutinize our budget and do what I did with human services, not hurt anybody, and find ways to lean up the system to make it sustainable. This is going to be cash out of our pocket, 3.5%. And we'll say, oh, it's going to go down as expenses go down. But they don't have to reduce it. It's only based upon the expenses. Every penny that comes out of this doesn't come out of a business or out of some fat cat somewhere with a cigar. It's coming out of wages of hospital workers. It's coming out of the pocketbooks of small and individual purchasers. And it's coming out of people. And every penny you can save comes right back into somebody's pocketbook, either in terms of better benefits for a hospital worker or some family being able to go on vacation because they worked really hard. So that's my impassioned speech, and I'm sincere in this. So I'm not going to push it now, but just think about it. And if there's some way to have some oversight by somebody without doing harm, even a commissioner just that they have to report to or something. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Loring, Representative Liebling. Senator Loring.
I think it's a mischaracterization to be trying to say that there is no oversight. There is significant oversight of the budget of this board. It has to be there's a federal requirement that there be an annual audit, independent audit paid for by the board. That'll be done. We took the House language on making sure that the OLA is really mandated to do their work in overseeing it. We have the budget reports coming back to the Legislative Advisory Committee that now we have empowered in other ways to make it a better functioning board, empowered just for the rulemaking, not to stop the budgets. But I think that empowering them in that manner will make them a more engaged committee. And they will be getting the budget as well. There is going to be significant oversight of the budget. I think that in light of the fact that we still have as one of the open issues how we finance this, I'm not sure we're even ready to adopt one of these amendments. I mean, the Senate has certification of costs and then transfer from the health impact fee. The House has the withhold. I really don't know how this would fit, and those are very different mechanisms. I understand your point, and I want to make clear as well that I really was in no way implicating motives on either your motion here on one of these three amendments or on the ones that we saw in the Senate. I don't challenge members on their motives. But I'm looking at the practical realities that occur if we adopt one of these, and it really does raise the specter of throwing substantial roadblocks into the certainty that this exchange board is going to need to have in order to set their budget and their policies and their planning and make sure that they know that they'll be able to function in the way that they need to. And I'm comfortable that we have significant oversight on several levels, as I just described earlier. So I respect your and appreciate your impassioned speech, and do believe that we've reached a place that does meet your goals. I know you disagree with that, but I think that we have the oversight that we need of the budget, and would respectfully still oppose if you were to move any one of these three amendments.
Mr. Chair. Did you want to say something?
Well, I just wanted to ask Senator Laurie if you referenced the financing. I was wondering yet if the Senate had seen the error of their ways in using the general fund and health impact fee to fund this. But
Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler.
I think they're still working on seeing the merit of your point. I just want to offer one more thing, and I just given either financing mechanism, I actually referenced the House one, where they automatically is withdrawn, but on the Senate version, where you admitted last night or we discussed its general fund, there is, I don't know, one other tap on the general fund that goes on unrestricted, like maple sap, just to go out until you quit putting buckets there. It's appropriated automatically, and it's all retrospective. And the OLA audits it a year or so late, and the Oversight Committee does rules, and I commend you. That's really a good improvement. At least they have some rules they can kind of somebody tweeted it was fangs, and I liken that. That's an improvement. But I just want to caution you as you think about this in our break time. How would you oversee this, and what would be a safe way to oversee it? I thought I picked three friendly ways, but if there's a fourth way that you could conjure up, I think you might look back and be happy that there's not a general fund. If you would prevail on the Senate side and you get general fund, that general fund's coming out of us. And it's going to, because they always go to us because we got the big money, you know. And so it's going to be a COLA. It's going to be something that we're going to have to trade it off for. And that's all. So I'll stop now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And actually, members, in light of the time, we've got to be done at 11 o'clock anyway. We've got two big issues that we had some discussion yesterday. We had some discussion the day before about the guarantees or lack of guarantees that carriers have of getting products into the exchange, and then we've got what's been alluded to now, which is the way that it's financed. And I'd suggest that we're probably not going to make a whole lot of headway on those issues in the next 11 minutes. So we will adjourn at this point until 8 p.m. We will really try to start at 8 p.m., so if you can do your darndest to get here, it'd be appreciated. The only thing that would change that is if you get some follow-up that we've heard there's something that's fallen out of bed, and we'd get an email.
Recess.
And we are
not adjourned.
I'm just talking right now.
You said adjourned.
I said it, but I know better.
Adjourned or recessed?
At this point, we are recessed until 8 p.m.